Okay, so my name is Daniel Schur. I'm the Associate Director of the Innovations for Successful Societies Project, and I'm here in Durban with Dr. Mike Sutcliffe, the City Manager. So thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule. As I said, I know you've got many other pressing issues on the go, so I appreciate you meeting with me.
Sure.
And before we sort of dive into some of the questions I had for you, I was wondering if you'd just mind briefly sort of introducing yourself and telling me a little bit about your background.
Okay. My name is Michael Sutcliffe. I'm City Manager of eThekwini Municipality, which incorporates the City of Durban. It's a city of about 4 million people. In effect, I'm the head of the administration and accounting officer, and the way our local government system works is, in effect, the city managers are appointed by the majority political party, obviously, in this case it's the ANC, for terms of contracts which are roughly equivalent to the elected office contracts. I head up an administration of about 20,000 employees and a budget of about 23 billion rand. That's about $3 billion, I suppose. The functions of a municipality would obviously be your developmental functions, things like housing, water, sanitation, electricity, water. Obviously, they're also driving tourism development, driving economic development, industrial development, driving the development of strategic areas like the port, etc. And then obviously a whole range of other things like art galleries and museums and libraries, etc. So it's fairly wide-spanning there. My background, I did a PhD at Ohio State on politics of turf. I then was a professor of town regional planning in South Africa, and obviously worked within the liberation movement. In the United Democratic Front, publicly, I was the chairperson of an organization called the Durban Democratic Association, which was attempt to mobilize whites against the apartheid regime. Mm-hmm. So we organized big movements in the 1980s of opening up the beaches and opening up the hospitals, etc. Mm-hmm. But obviously working also with the ANC from about 1984, I suppose, on a project entitled Post-Apartheid South Africa. So at that stage, people like the former president Thabo Mbeki, the current president Jacob Zuma, they were all quite instrumental from pretty much 1985 onwards, where we were really trying to develop policy guidelines. So there was a team of us from inside the country and a team from outside the country who were in exile, and we worked quite closely together in collaborating on documents which eventually became known as the RDP, they became known as the Constitutional Guidelines for Democratic South Africa, became part of our negotiating positions. Mm-hmm. By the time we got to 1990 and the release of Mandela, I then moved for a couple of years to University of Durban Westville as the Director of Public Affairs, but then went into politics in the first elections. It was a decision taken that because we lost the province, the ANC pretty much won the rest of the country, but at that stage the Inkatha Freedom Party won this. So those of us in the leadership of the ANC here pretty much remained here and didn't go to national government. So I was in the legislature here under Jacob Zuma's leadership at that stage. 1999, President Mandela then appointed me as the chairperson of a board called the Municipal Demarcation Board, which was the board that redrew all of the boundaries in order for us to hold democratic municipal elections, because obviously at that stage the majority of the country was divided up into white and Indian and coloured areas, and then you had vast rural areas with no local government. So my job, the whole country, so it was called the Municipal Demarcation Board. So I was the first full-time chair, in a sense. It became known as Michael's demolition. I don't know what B stood for, but anyway, Michael's demolition board, because it was our job was to demolish the old apartheid boundaries. Then in 2002, the ANC decided to redeploy me as the city manager of eThekwini Municipality, which incorporated about 40 previous municipalities, as well as some fairly large areas that were part of the KwaZulu-Natal Bantustan. Mm-hmm. So at the moment it's about 4 million people. December it grows to about 5 million people, because it's obviously South Africa's main domestic tourist destination. And that's my job today, is to try and deal with the myriad of things that obviously we have to deal with at the moment.
Excellent. Well, thank you. One of the things I'd be quite interested in hearing from you as somebody who was on this the project entitled Post-Apartheid South Africa. Now, I've spoken with certain parties who advocated federalism as a solution for post-apartheid, the shape of the post-apartheid state. And one of the things that these players frequently bring up is this almost specter of the ANC's unitary state, this highly centralized, extremely sort of controlling bureaucracy that they claim the ANC was envisaging as the shape of the post-apartheid state. Mm. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit on what was actually being envisaged as an alternative to these sort of more federal models that were being put forward by other parties.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if you go back to where a lot of these post-apartheid projects began, as I said, Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma were probably the key leaders within the ANC that were driving that. And obviously I was working within and with them quite closely on that. Obviously, at that stage, until 1987, or roughly then, we really had a view that our struggle is firstly for national democracy, and to not really waste our time in trying to think of subnational democratic forms. Although what happened was, in about 1985, I think it was, there was a small group of us that then were set up that started looking at the local government question, partly because internally the struggles that we'd had, both our underground and the UDF that was operating legally at that stage, we knew that the reality of South Africa is that the local struggles were driving the struggle for democracy, and that question had to be addressed. If you look at, for example, in the UDF, we had in all of our major cities a struggle over one city, one tax base, for example. So in the 1980s, at an underground level and above ground, our arguments were to begin to reshape the form, because apartheid divided people on geographic lines, black people, African people, colored, Indian, white. So for the first 4 or 5 years of the work that we were doing, the subnational forms of the state were not directly part of that agenda. But probably by about 1987, 1988, we'd obviously started beginning work on what that future form of the state might be, because we knew that we would have to do something about the Bantustans. They had already Bantustans and provinces in the white South Africa. So we then produced a little discussion document called the 10 Regions of South Africa. And in fact, it was probably L.B. Sachs and I, if I could remember, who then tried to, what I had done in one of the papers and I'd done and arguments I'd developed internally around that time, was really to say that the material base, because obviously from a Marxist perspective, the material base of a society is what you would work with. Form always follows functions. You don't start by saying, what form does the state take before you're saying what functions does the state have? And we started emerging then is to really say is that the form of that future state, we needed to talk through the regions. Obviously, when the ANC was unbanned in 1980, it decided on 14 regions, in part because there were existing UDF formations, but in part also because of the ANC's own history. Now, they were also, there was a bit of a disjuncture there, because if you look at places like in those 14 regions within the ANC, you had some kind of oddities in them, as it were. And I suppose by the time we then got to 1989, 1990, we then realized that that's a very important issue that as an ANC, we must start coming to grips with. Now, the model that we had then, broadly speaking, and I'm not saying it was never officially, so I'm not saying that the ANC as an official level had that, because we remained a party arguing for a unitary state, and we still remain a party arguing for a unitary state. That was very clear. But we had realized that the form of that unitary state must allow for subnational government. And the model that we sort of emerged then was probably to divide the country up into a number of regions, anything from 20 to 50 regions across the country. Now, at that stage, we never really debated that issue, because the historical form of the ANC was to divide the ANC along provincial boundary lines. In the original days, there were four provinces: Transvaal, Natal, Western, Free State, and the Cape. And so that form of the ANC pretty much had stayed for many years. But what we were beginning to develop was really ideas of saying that form doesn't make sense, because you have areas that are just economically, functionally, geographically too vast to deal with things. So we produced a paper, I think, around that stage. It was a broad discussion paper on the 10 regions of South Africa, I think we called it, or whatever, by about 1990. Now, that was the work that we were doing within the movement. Obviously, there was also work happening as we started the negotiations process. Obviously, with Mandela's release, there was then the Groote Schuur Minute, and then it started a negotiations process. Our view was, as we'd outlined in the 1987 document, was to get all parties around the table, but obviously the two major parties were the regime and the ANC. But to try and make it as inclusive as possible, and that was really our strategy, and we had tactics to try and deal with that, because obviously managing that was difficult, and you remember the debates that we had around sufficient consensus and the like. But it was really, to a large extent, driven by those two parties. Now, what became very clear from day one was a argument. I think we called it the PVR debate, didn't we? PSR debate, wasn't it? It was the provinces, states, and regions debate, where, in a sense, onto the table were put the provinces. Some parties argued that there should be a subnational, and must have a form of federalism with the provinces. Some argued it should be a real federalism with states, which would have real powers, not just nominal powers, and then the regions, which was more the ANC, that you have our country divided geographically, but really acting as oversight areas, as post boxes of national government, etc. So that was the kind of debate that occurred there. What we then did as a separate path, beginning around, I've forgotten when the year was, but it actually had predated 1990, we then began to formalize the local government negotiations, because obviously local government was a critical area. And continuing our theme of one city, one tax base, we obviously then, in the early 90s, then started a lot of local forums, negotiating forums. So we had a local government negotiating forum, which was a national body primarily between the ANC and the National Party government, but at a local level involving many other parties. And we called them, some of them, the statutory parties, those who were already in the system, and non-statutory. So there was a process that was already starting to bubble by the early 90s, as it were. So almost two negotiations going on, which the ANC then began to coordinate its approach in both of those, because it didn't want a situation, quite correctly, where local governments then entrenched things that the national negotiations were not going to allow. So in some ways, we almost slowed those down, we regrouped, we made sure that we still made advances at a local level, but focusing on the big picture thing. Now, it was in that context of the big picture that we really then had to talk our way through how do we deal with these different models. And basically, we came up with a model that spoke of spheres of government. And so we did something in our approach then as a country, and that was entrenched in the Constitution later, mm-hmm. is to say that because of the history of protest and democracy at a local level, the ANC as a grouping by then, because now it was a united ANC again, where it's underground, it's UDF structures, it's existing army, etc., where we were able to bring that into a single organization again, where obviously these movements for local democracy, particularly in the bigger towns and cities, it was not rurally led. The rural campaigns were really earlier in the 1950s, but these were much more led in the urban. A recognition by the ANC that sphere of government was important. So that's why we introduced this notion of three spheres of government. And I think that we're the only constitution in the world that actually entrenches three spheres of government with particular rights in their constitution. Now, that then ended, obviously, when we passed the constitution in 96 or whatever. That was the final form, the emerging negotiations took. But what was interesting about that final form in 1996 was that we really had, and if you read the Constitution of South Africa, you have to a certain extent a model for three spheres, and then you have the local sphere being a bit of a hodgepodge, and that was because of the Constitutional Court case that you had, where the Constitutional Court then ruled that we needed to change the model that we were working on at that stage, and it created what are called Category A, B, and C municipalities. And so that's a bit of a hodgepodge. And then when you get to the appendices of saying what are the functions and powers of these three spheres of government, you find that that's a real hodgepodge. Because obviously at that stage, we still remember the ANC was fighting for a unitary democracy. We really didn't have a chance to really engage and debate and understand even what the functions and powers of local government would be. So you'll find the sections 4 and 5 of the Constitution pretty much just saying, well, what happens at local government then? What happened under colonialism and apartheid? Just dump it in as a schedule in the back. It's created its own dynamics, because you will see the subsequent local government legislation starts then refining that a little bit more and starts talking very centrally about local government as a key vehicle for participatory democracy, participatory and representative democracy. It talks very clearly about the local sphere of government being the developmental wing of national government. You'll see the word development and the word community participation being used much more in that legislation than in any other legislation that we have in South Africa. Because as an ANC, we believe once we had passed the Constitution, we need to move in that direction of a developmental state, where your local sphere is the real developmental wing. But many of the developmental functions, if you just take health, for example, or you take housing, in the Constitution, they're lodged at a national and provincial level and not at a local level. Public transport is lodged at a national, provincial level, not at a local level. So it's created its own contradictions, I think, for the 1980s. So that gives you a little bit of a snapshot of the kind of processes we had. By the time we got to 96 and the Constitution was developed, we'd also formalized the process of local government democracy, which then envisaged three phases. One which was called the pre-whatever, the second was the transition, and then the third was the democratic phase. The pre, I've forgotten the name for the moment, but you can find it in the books, I'm sure. That phase was where we just created nominated councils, then we had some interim elections, and then in the year 2000, we had the final elections. But we could only have those final elections once we had demarcated new boundaries, which is the job that I was given to do with the demarcation board, and once we had created other legislation for local government, such as the Structures Act, the Systems Act, and then later the Finance Act. So that was the kind of work we did towards the end of the 1990s.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Excellent. I mean, there's quite a few things I'd like to pick up
sure.
on there.
Okay.
But one of the first questions I had as somebody who was obviously very active within the UDF was a claim I heard that the ANC structures began to make more concessions to provincial models and regional models based on how the UDF structures had been set up and how the UDF support bases were organized. And I was wondering if you could comment on whether that was in fact a significant factor or a significant feature in these talks and these processes.
Oh no, it was. I said to you, I used the example. There was a meeting that I attended where I made a presentation on the regional base for South Africa, linking the economic base to our existing UDF base,
okay,
to the political base. And out of that emerged a model of 10 regions, and eventually we made it 9 regions, 9 regions which became 9 provinces.
Okay.
Obviously within that there were some disputed areas, mm-hmm. and they're still areas that we would have dispute today. Now, we were able to move quite quickly to that because at a negotiating level, once we got our 9 provinces model on the map, it then was just a question of the National Party and other major players then sort of tweaking some of those boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
National Party, basically, they looked at that map and they said they'll nab the Western Cape then, they'll nab the Northern Cape, they'll nab Mpumalanga. They just presumed that would happen. So as they looked at the country, mm-hmm. they sort of thought, well, that's maybe where their bases are and where they might be able to. So, yes, we put on the agenda then the 9 regions. As I say, it went from the 14 regions of the ANC when the ANC was unbanned to 10 regions, and the 10 regions were really just keeping Transkei separate. And what we did was we changed that, and then it became the 9 provinces, basically. So that was the sort of process, how we evolved it.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I see. I mean, it's interesting that the National Party assumed that they'd win those.
Well, I think that was the logic, because, you know, when we took it to the national level, and I wasn't directly in those talks, I was advising our team and that, but they literally, that was why the cross-boundary problems were created. You remember there was a special commission that we established then, mm-hmm. of mainly the National Party and ourselves, to go and look at some of these areas. Now, the National Party wanted to keep all those border areas of Mpumalanga in Limpopo, and that's why you'd remember all the protests we had in Mutsi and places like that. Yeah. They also wanted to keep, and that was more our own people, wanted to take the Kokstad area and Umzimkulu, Kokstad and Matatiel back to the Eastern Cape, because remember, under apartheid, there'd been about 5 or 6 commissions around that particular boundary, and eventually it was the white areas, the white farms were all put into Natal. Umzimkulu and Maluti district were left in the Eastern Cape, or left in Transkei initially and then therefore the Eastern Cape. So there'd been a whole history to some of those boundary issues, as it were, which came back and flared up later, and then you had the Khotsong battles, etc. So all of those in the late, by the time we got to 2004, 2005, 2006, there's a whole process of how the ANC tried to manage those kinds of those boundary disputes, and they're still trying to manage them today. You know, if you look at places like Balfour, many of those issues are actually around service delivery. It's people who are within earshot, within, you know, if you look at Kokstad, is closer in geographical terms to Pietermaritzburg, to areas of delivery, even Umzimkulu is, than it is to, for example, East London or Bishu or mm-hmm. or Port Elizabeth. If you look at the areas of Mutsi, for example, they're closer to the white towns, if you could put it, those white villages and towns of Mpumalanga than they are to Polokwane. If you look at a lot of those, it's that people see Balfour, you know, you can see Johannesburg, yeah. but now they're part of Mpumalanga. Yeah. So instead of focusing on the service delivery element, the focus is then on change the boundaries. And that's why I'm a firm believer that you don't use boundaries to solve functional issues. And that's why my own view would be to scrap the provinces, because provinces are just a sphere of government that confuses everything. Mm-hmm. But that's a personal view. I will remain an activist in the ANC, arguing that that's the route we should go, but mm-hmm. it's always difficult when you would obviously have interests at a provincial level. So that's a personal view, and I will continue to argue that we don't need provinces. I think the nature of the world today is that you have strong local governments and you have strong national and transnational governments. Those are really the two spheres where there's most contestation. Whether you're in any developed stroke democratic part of the world, you'll find that the shape, that's what's emerging. So even in a country like France, for example, you actually find that in France you've got 36,000 municipalities, but those individual municipalities are really historic relics. They were there because of the Industrial Revolution, but actually you've got metropolitan areas now that there's much more integration occurring at a kind of metropolitan area in Europe. So Europe today is really 10 or 12 or 15 maybe major metropolitan areas, spheres of influence, than, you know, even though their geographic boundaries don't demonstrate that.
I just wanted to pick up on what you're talking about of not using boundaries to solve service delivery problems. Mm-hmm. And I think something that's very apparent is that some provinces have functioned much, much better than others. Yeah. And that some have to I've heard some comments on certain provinces having, to all intents and purposes, sort of failed at the moment. And I was wondering if you could comment on why some seem to have performed better than others. And whether that was something that perhaps could have been envisaged or could have been predicted prior to the formation of these provinces?
Look, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I think that some of them, it's around capacity. Remember, we had to construct completely new provinces. So just as people will point and say local government has failed, local governments have as a whole not all failed. What has happened is that, remember, in the case of provinces, we created five brand new provinces. Just take the ones that we created from pretty much scratch. Limpopo was largely the northern province, but if you actually look at Limpopo, it consisted of, I think there must have been five Bantustans in it. Now, its job had been to try and merge this very fragmented state back into what was originally the province. Now, with an ANC coming in and swamping in that area, you still had that capacity problem because you still had these interests, if you could put it that way, from these five or six regional governments that existed there. You know, there was a Venda state, there was a this state, that state, and the other. If you look at Transvaal, which was the second part of the puzzle of the original, if you look at the Johannesburg base of that, you then, in a sense, took out from that and created a brand new province in the shape of Mpumalanga. But you kind of had the high veld and the low veld. So you had those areas that functionally were linked to Johannesburg, but now are being put into almost something that doesn't make sense, that their functional link is back to Mpumalanga. So, and if you add to it the kind of conflict at the boundary area between Limpopo and Mpumalanga, again you get a war emerging there. So that the ability for provincial leadership to properly manage that process was more constrained. I'll add some other problems in a minute, but I think so. The second problem that you had is that, you know, you then in a sense were taking the economic heartland of Gauteng and the capacity, and you were out of two other areas. So Limpopo and Mpumalanga then are faced with the challenges of a lack of existing capacity, hugely fragmented state, a dominant single party, ANC getting 90% of the vote there, but actually once it gets 90% of the vote, it now has to deal with a whole lot of sets of different interests that emerge, and sometimes some squabbles that emerge. And it's got to deal with these boundary issues where people want to be not in Limpopo, they want to be in Mpumalanga. So the result is that the ability to manage that then becomes constrained, because you want to keep the unitary side of the ANC, which is winning votes wonderfully, but it's more difficult because you now have, once the ANC is in majority, it just rules the roost. And the ability for corruption to emerge there, for local interests to start dictating things, become even more significant. Seeing the state as a quick way to get rich, all of those things start emerging then. Mm-hmm. So it's both the objective reality of the nature of that state, as well as the subjective conditions under which that state was emerging, that influenced those three areas. Free State stayed largely as it was, but in the case of Free State, to a certain extent, it was the dominance of the ruling party, and then a scrap that emerged between, as it became known, as the Terre Lakota and ACE, Makgashule. To a certain extent, that just hampered that ability. To a certain extent, it was a kind of struggle of the northern part, which was dominant, versus the south, the kind of Mangaon, etc. So again, to a certain extent, the Free State dynamic, I think, got hampered a little bit. Mm-hmm. So even though it was a single provincial government, with a little bit of it had to incorporate a very poor, probably the poorest of all the homeland areas. It certainly ranks with KZN in that as that. So it had to bring all these Mapelis and the Bantustans there into that framework, as well as then this political dynamic. So it was yes, there's some existing capacity on the former white administration, and almost absolutely no capacity in the former homelands that it inherited. So that's its first dimension. The second dimension is a bit of a struggle, almost a sense of, my reading from here, an imposed leader in the case of Terre Lakota, versus the kind of emergent democratically elected leader in the form of ACE, for example. And so the kind of conflicts that emerged there. So I think that created its own battleground. I think the Northern Cape there, it was really just the vastness of that. Mm-hmm. That is when you have a provincial government sitting in Kimberley, the question is, what is it supposed to do? When it really is, Kimberley's budget, its personnel, is far smaller than the municipality of Durban. Mm-hmm. But here it's a province, needing to have all the trappings of a provincial government. So, you know, did it fail, did it whatever? I'm just saying is that I think that that all of these are not, for me, saying that provinces have failed. It's more that our model has shown that we shouldn't have provinces. And I think that's the more important question that we should be posing. When you get to the Western Cape, obviously that's the area that the majority of South Africa's wealth and the state had invested massively in that area. You know, a Tygerberg Hospital, a Groote Schuur Hospital, mm-hmm. two of the best state hospitals in the country. So a massive concentration of resources there, of capacity, you know, very little developmental challenges. Yes, in the former township areas, but they were not needed by the voting base there, because the ANC was always going to have difficulty getting a majority in a context like that, where you had such stark developmental and racial differences as you had there. When you get to the Eastern Cape, again, you've got the old two Bantustan problems, both Ciskei and Transkei, which both had coups, both had had an incredibly run-down state machinery, but still people employed by the state there. So no one could say that those two had had any kind of functioning, certainly in the last 10 years of them being Bantustans. So it's not like the state, in the, so suddenly you get an ANC coming in, its base is shifted towards, let's call it Bishu and Port Elizabeth, so it's more developed side of it, but actually the political base is this rural Ciskei and Transkei issue. So how do you manage that both subjectively, where and you've got to deal with a state apparatus that really hasn't worked for years? How do you get them revitalized to actually now be part of this democratic challenge? Again, not easy. If you then get to the last of my as I move around, you would have KwaZulu-Natal. Again, you had an election that was flawed in this province, but in the interests of the national problematic, the ANC in the province here withdrew its court case. It had prepared legal papers to challenge the 94 elections. Mm-hmm. It was really the intervention of President Mandela, who really said that, look, in the interests of the country, let's move on and deal with it. And as you've seen progressively then, since then, mm-hmm. the ANC in this province has basically won over. But that was 10 years later. So what you had was in 1994 a continuation of a Bantustan administration. It was only in 2004 that you probably get a real, because for 10 years then the IFP that controlled the province, initially by itself and then together with the in coalition, you find for 10 years then it basically was a Bantustan, extended slightly. And its battles with the national government, everything was a battle over the constitution, a battle over the Ingunyama areas, etc. Mm. So if you go around the country and you actually look at that, as I said to you, the question I would pose is it really a failure of provinces or a failure that we had introduced that form of government in a democratic dispensation? And I think it's much more the latter.
I see. Excellent. Well, thank you. That was an excellent overview of the situation.
Actually. That's
going to be very helpful.
Oh, good. Maybe I should develop it as a paper.
That was a fantastic rundown of the specific problems of all these different of the different provinces, and I think it sort of lends weight to the fact that maybe the problem is not the provinces; the problem is the model that was imposed on these
from the negotiating context. Yeah. Remember, these were late night things. I mean, there was a cokie pen that was used very late at night to decide where some of these areas went in. And to a certain extent, and you know, what I saw in this province is that when I served under Jacob Zuma here, we probably, even though we only had 30% of the legislature, to a large extent we controlled the legislature, but we didn't control the state. So even though we didn't have 51%, we thwarted the IFP's constitution. We thwarted them every stop there, but because we didn't have that state machinery. And so I think because there was such political contestation in a province like KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng to a certain extent, and to a certain extent Western Cape, if you take those three, to a large extent, they've at least been able to keep their administrations running. In the others, there was no political contestation which was occurring, but you had these massive problems within the state machinery itself because of the Bantustans, and that created its own dynamic there.
So I'm conscious of time, and what I wanted to ask you was just a couple of questions of related to Nkata and some of the demands they were making. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the thwarting of the KZN constitution, which some have labeled as a secessionist document.
Sure.
And I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about the dynamic of being in Natal and working with this party that was taking very hard lines on issues today that seem somewhat obscure, for example, the role of the king in the constitution.
Well, the irony was that their constitution, you know, I've said to people, the real irony of the IFP is that it is not a party. It's a set of interests which are held together by their leader. I think he's a very talented politician. Could well be very well advised, but it's very difficult. Now, let me use it as an example. If you actually look at the Indaba, I think it was the Nkata Commission, was it? Mm-hmm. It was a commission in the 1980s about Arulia. You go and find what their model was for traditional areas and for the king, and you'll find nothing. You go and look at the constitution that they presented in 1994-95, that we then eventually made sure that it couldn't go forward, and you'll find there's no role for the king, mm-hmm. no role for traditional leaders or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was an Ambassini document. Mm-hmm. Its focus was on, as you say, secession. Its focus was not on the things that, as a party, they've always argued they stood for. Mangosuthu Buthelezi will always argue that he's always stood for traditional leaders. He stood for traditional leaders in his image. That's what he stood for. Not for traditional leadership as historically it might have been known. It in fact was the ANC who legitimized the role and the function of the king of the Zulus and of traditional leaders. So it's always kind of a bit of an irony that you had a constitution being thrust on the legislature here. I mean, there's all sorts of things that still stand out in my mind of having Ambrosini, who was Mario Ambrosini, was the I'm sure American-trained, Italian-born, right-wing constitution maker, as it were. I still have in my mind when we were in the legislature debating, and you'd see him peering through the curtains outside, because there were kind of curtains downstairs to see what was happening, you know. And so, anyway, and so we tactically and strategically, I think, defeated them quite well. There's all sorts of stories we could tell about how we organized our forces, how Jacob Zuma made sure he organized us well enough on the final nights of negotiations, and we clapped the hell out of them. Excuse the French. But anyway, we did.
Are there stories you can relate?
Well, they were about that. We organized ourselves as we were now, it was down to the final moments, and now we needed to get into battle mode. So the key thing was to keep some of their key groups and forces isolated. And as we negotiated through the night, we would have one pocket in a corner here, another pocket of the IFP in a corner there, another pocket there. They were so disoriented and so whacked by the way in which we dealt with these things that they pretty much gave in on a lot of these issues, or at least gave in a model that they thought was enhancing their secessionist vision, but was giving us the grounds to make sure that this thing would never get through any constitutional challenge.
Okay, fair enough. And then just in the last few minutes we have, one issue we haven't really spoken much about was this issue of violence. I mean, this is especially during the negotiation period. I mean, a lot of these discussions are occurring with a backdrop of unbelievable violence in KwaZulu-Natal, which has, by my perception, sort of largely been overlooked in a lot of retrospectives of the transitional period, that there's a sort of forgetting that a lot of people died, and for a long time on, you know, this area, this province, was on a sort of knife edge due to these clashes between Nkata and UDF and ANC. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that time period and how these issues of violence played into the negotiations and some of the demands that were being made.
Well, they obviously played into the negotiations and demands. So obviously the IFP would have its list of people who'd been killed in the violence. Of course, it would always use figures like 20,000 people, etc. Mm. When you actually said, well, show us the actual list, they were never near that number. But yes, it is true that there was horrific violence going on. But I think firstly you've got to understand, and I think that's where Jacob Zuma probably, given his intelligence background, really focused on the peacemaking process. If you actually look at what he did, he took the IFP leadership, particularly that leadership immediately below Buthelezi, by the hand and targeted certain areas. And he targeted in those areas where it appeared like ANC and IFP. He targeted areas where it appeared like ANC versus ANC. And he targeted those areas which I think, in hindsight, and Jacob Zuma is not the sort of person that will ever tell you whether this was the case, mm-hmm. but my own reading from being part of that process and seeing, was that I think that it was his intelligence understanding of realizing that the nature of that violence was that this was not ethnic, first of all, because the ANC in this province, even at the first election, got more than 1 million votes from people who are defined as Zulu. The IFP got about 1.4 million votes of people defined as Zulu. So it wasn't ethnic, which is, if you look at the many of the other liberation wars where you'd have those conflicts, Angola being one, there were sharp ethnic differences that existed. They weren't necessarily completely geographical differences either, although largely to the south of the Tugela was more ANC and to the north of the Tugela was more IFP. Thirdly is that it was clear that this was being managed and handled. Whether it was from one spot or whether it was from a variety of spots, it certainly was. So that you had on the one hand IFP, as it's now been shown, and elements within the ANC being handled by the former security branch and the South African system. But equally, I knew in the 1980s, the Americans themselves were planning, or elements within the Americans, let's not blame all of them, were already planning for a RENAMO-style context, a sort of RENAMO continuation down here. And there's no doubt in my mind if you could ever get access to what was going on there, because I don't think that this was just a South African issue, you'd realize that in fact, the anecdotal things that I saw, there were some people linked to World Vision who themselves were setting up where camps would be and things like that. Mm-hmm. We knew of a lot of that stuff coming. Ambassini didn't just appear. Now the question is that I'm not saying there was a single conspiracy in this, or a single group that had said this is how you destabilize South Africa, mm-hmm. but certainly there were elements like that. So you had a complex of these things happening, and I think that to a certain extent, if I look back, even though I didn't understand it as much more then, I think that Jacob Zuma played a much bigger role than I think we understand for that, because he understood the nature of this complex arrangement of violence, which doesn't really have a material base amongst the people themselves. Because, you know, all of the people here are supposedly have a Zulu background, and materially they are. And I think that he understood that there wasn't that material base. So to a large extent, this was violence that was being imposed by local leaders, local warlords, right through to those who had the support of state machinery behind them. Now, that obviously was happening. It influenced to a certain extent some of the negotiations. But, you know, I still remember because I drove the process of the local negotiating forum in Durban while I was dealing with some of the national stuff. I also drove this forum here. And, you know, I was able to, in all those engagements with the IFP, to a large extent, build a fairly rational picture of that. So I, and in my engagements with him, including people from, you know, the leader of the IFP, right through to the present Secretary General, Musa Zondi, etc. Mm-hmm. All people who we engaged around. So, you know, and that also, I think, was also an indication that quite a lot of this violence was not being directed by the senior leadership of the IFP or the senior leadership of the ANC. You know, that's why I said some of it might have been local enmity, but a lot of it was being handled by other state forces. So our own engagements, you know, it was affected, but it wasn't really affected at the level that I would say, you know, that became the dominant issue. The dominant issue became about who's going to have more power than who, and how can we outmaneuver the others to make sure they have less power.
Excellent. Well, I think that does that bring
cool.
us to the end of our time.
No, that's
so
fine.
I wanted to thank you very much.
Pleasure. And if there are any other questions or issues that you want to cover, feel free to call.